We do have a few moments.
I'm very sorry, I've talked much too long.
It's quite all right. Just a brief discussion, and those of you who are interested in staying and listening, I'm sure that it'll be well worthwhile. John, Mr. Post, would you like to...
I'm afraid my question shows a certain optimism which may not be justified. In a way, your quote from Hausmann, that malt does more than Milton can to justify God's ways to man, indicates that my remarks may show that I'm looking into the pewter pot to see the world as the world is not. At any rate, I'm a bit worried about your picture, the picture you paint, that the future may contain a number of monolithic scientific dictatorships, and that there may be a groundswell in this direction, a groundswell caused by the human tendency to seek pleasure where it can be found. But I'm struck by the fact that movements of that sort are always far more complex than any of our attempts at characterizing them. And I think that perhaps in this complexity lies a ray of hope, that the future may not contain such monolithic scientific dictatorships, and that the developments which we can expect in light of the various technological achievements you mentioned may not lead in the direction of scientific dictatorships in the way you indicate, that this may depend to a great extent upon the nature or the characteristics of the nations in which these results are first introduced. In other words, my question really is, when you project into the future and you say that the chances are very great of dictatorships of this kind occurring, could you qualify a bit more what the chances are?
Well, I don't think the chances are very great. I think they are there. And I would think that one of the reasons why we may get more dictatorships than we like lies in quite a different field. I mean, with large parts of the world increasing at 3% per annum in the population, goodness knows what is going to happen. I mean, for example, I was in India last autumn, and of course this is unutterably depressing, the enormous poverty, and the depression grew a great deal with the announcement, just when we were there, that the United Nations had come to the conclusion that its earlier estimates of the increase of Indian population were very much too low. The estimates had been in the neighborhood of 1.7% per annum, which is about the same as the United States, which had to be corrected up to 2.2 or 2.3, which I think doubles the population in about 32 years. And, of course, there are large parts of the world where the increase is fully 3%, and in certain parts of the world even 4%. I mean, 3% doubles the population in 24 years, and 4%, I forget, in about 16, I think. But it seems to me that the danger in regard to dictatorship arises with as the population presses more heavily upon resources, and as the rising tide of expectation, which certainly exists in these underdeveloped countries, is frustrated, as undoubtedly it is going to be, because it is almost impossible to make any development which shall catch up with, much less go faster than the population increase. So we may get a great deal of social unrest, and of course social unrest leads first to chaos and then to dictatorship. I mean, I think that the prospect of some kind of dictatorship, either military or communistic, I think in most cases more likely military, seems to me very great within the next 15 to 20 years. And whether some of these dictatorships may make use of these modern methods remains to be seen. But I think that, unhappily, the prospects for dictatorships in large areas of the world seem to me very great at the moment. I think that there is a considerable likelihood of this thing happening.
The implication seems to be that we ought to be apprehensive that these techniques fall into the hands of dictatorships, demagogues, etc. But I could easily envisage a situation where Western democracies could use these methods, such as electrodes attached to the brain of the SAC, in order to avoid accidental war. This could be put in very moral terms. Or that you give soma to the discontented minority of the population who are suffering from anomia, etc. Would you care to comment about the use of these techniques by democracy, by democratic states?
Well, you're a lot more pessimistic than I am. But maybe your pessimism is justified. The awful fact remains that when techniques have been discovered, sooner or later they tend to be applied. And in these techniques, where the object of application is the human being, you're obviously up against the most dangerous situation. And what will be the temptation for those in power? I mean, after all, we pray regularly not to be led into temptation, and this is a very profound and important prayer. I mean, experience sadly shows that if we are tempted long enough and strongly enough, we almost invariably succumb, and that the whole process of setting up a decent society is essentially setting up a society in which temptations to abuse power and shall be reduced to a minimum. But these new techniques, I think, do constitute a series of very powerful temptations, which to those in authority may be finally turn out to be irresistible. I hope not, but I think what you say is something which we have to think about. I mean, that this might be applied with justification, as you say, in the highest patriotic and moral terms, even in democratic societies. I trust not, but one never knows, particularly under conditions of extreme military stress.
It would appear, sir, that the type of dictatorship which you have outlined for us here today and more detail in the Brave New World would tend to be self-perpetuating unless there's a rise, such a sharp social crisis as to disrupt the pattern of authority and break the hold which is being passed on from one generation to the other in these terms. But it would appear that the type of social crisis involved in large-scale warfare, whether it be nuclear warfare or otherwise, or the type of crisis involved in a widespread famine, etc., would tend to disrupt this pattern of dictatorship. Therefore, would you say that it's necessary to have a high degree of social stability in terms of economic conditions, in terms of world peace, before a dictatorship of the sort you have described for us would be able to really imprint itself upon a population?
This, I think, is very important. I mean, I think it's obvious that such a dictatorship, if it were going to survive, would have to guarantee the adequate food supplies. I mean, and whether it could in fact do this while the kind of international tensions, whether we can expect a long-lasting dictatorship within the context of nationalism, I don't know. I don't think so. I think we can expect dictatorships to arise, but not long-lasting ones. I mean, I think that even the best organized dictatorship within the context of nationalism is likely, as you say, to lead to break itself down, because one side of the paranoid state of mind will lead it into conflict, which will, of course, destroy it, finally destroy it. I mean, this is a very important point. And then, of course, another point which was made by Sir Charles Darwin in his book, The Next Million Years, which I think was one which, in different terms, I envisaged in Brave New World. I mean, he points out that the human species is still a wild species. It has never been domesticated. I mean, a domesticated species is one which has been tamed by another species. Well, until we get an invasion from Mars, we shall not be tamed by another species. All we can do is to try to tame ourselves, that an oligarchy tries to tame ourselves. But the oligarchy still remains wild. I mean, however much it succeeded in taming the domesticating the rest of the race, it must remain wild. And this was the part of the fable, the dramatic part of the fable of Brave New World, is that the people in the upper hierarchy who were not ruthlessly conditioned could break down. And I mean, this Charles Darwin insists that because man is wild, he can never expect to domesticate himself, because the people on top will always be undomesticated and will sooner or later always run wild. Well, I think there's a good deal to be said for this this point of view in regard to the permanence of any dictatorship.
Yes, I have a question. I'm worried about a relationship that seems to exist between cost, consent, and control. Mm. If a government wants to control its people, of course its job will be easier if they are more willing to consent, and the job will be correspondingly more costly if the corresponding consent isn't there. Could you make a few remarks about the economic feasibility of introducing biological controls of the sort you talk about?
I don't know. I mean, wouldn't it? I would have thought in some ways it would be cheaper than maintaining very large security forces and concentration camps and so on. In asylums, chemical control is a great deal simpler and cheaper than physical control. I mean, the bad old days of straight jackets and manacles and so on required quite a lot of people to handle the insane, whereas the tranquilizers seem to require much fewer. I mean, that you can get equal results with simpler and certainly pleasanter means. I have no idea about the actual cost situation, but it seems to me that it might actually be cheaper. I don't know.
Well, I see that some of you are leaving for your 4 o'clock classes. Now, I will give you an opportunity to leave now. If Mr. Huxley would be willing, we might be able to entertain some questions from the floor for a few moments, would you say?
Certainly, yes.
Will those of you who are obliged to leave now, please stand?
I apologize having gone on so long.
Oh, no, that's fine. I'm sure I much prefer to hear you discuss these questions and what happened, we might be able to show up. I hope you're not finding it as uncomfortably warm in here.
Well, it's getting a little warm, isn't it? It seems to be a completely windowless hall, isn't it?
It's part of the conditioning process, I'm sure. Oh.
Is there any means of ventilation in this hall? I see one door there.
But the next Tuesday at 2. Next Tuesday at 2. I think there is some ventilation. The ventilation never seems to be able to meet the demand. Wasn't it a conference in Santa Barbara discussing some of these developments, the new drugs? And
no, they were mainly discussing, there was a lot about the problem of bringing technology to the underdeveloped countries. They had a lot of people from the United Nations there, a very able man, who was a Vietnamese called Vu Van Thai. Charming man. He was spoke English with a strong French accent because he'd learned his economics in Paris. And he was very interesting. I mean, he said, I'm speaking to you like a rat with electrodes in my brain because I speak from the inside. I'm not one of the experimenters on the outside. So, and he was very interesting about it. I mean, about the difficulty that when you do introduce, say, one area of highly evolved technique into one of these backward countries, you create an enormous gap between the people who run this thing and profit by it and the mass of the population. A gap which is just as serious as the gap between the have-not and underdeveloped nations as a whole, and those who and the haves and the developed. And what he was saying was that you must have an adaptation of technique which shall be suitable for these people and not try to bring in what you have already. But he says very little work has been done in this field. And there were several very able people. Richard Calder at the University of Edinburgh was there, and Arthur Goldschmidt, who is the director of the special services in the United Nations. And we had some extremely good talks.
Bring that up shortly. But I have one question here, which is, this is essentially the question which Mr. Huxley addressed himself to in his last statement. How will control over the techniques be transmitted from one group to another? Apparently referring to how do the control of techniques be transmitted from one elite, one generational elite to another. Would you wish to comment further on this question? I know you did speak to it just before.
I don't think so. I do think there will clearly be a difficulty. There is always a difficulty in transferring power. After all, written constitutions such as in the United States, or a hereditary monarchy, in which you got de facto power being de jure, and the possibility of passing power on without much hitch from one generation to another. It may be that in a thoroughly well-controlled dictatorship, the problem of power at the top, the struggle for power, would not take place. But even there, simply because, again, because the oligarchy is itself not subjected to the extremes of conditioning, because it must retain a certain freedom in order to be able to make adequate decisions, that maybe the struggle for power would always remain a great problem, as it has been throughout history, except where you have had written constitutions or acceptable monarchies.
Yes?
Dr. Huxley, did you adhere to the view or comment on the view that it's precisely the American society of Western democracy that is particularly susceptible to this type of brave new world for the following reason, that society is conditioned to adhere to a great degree of social conformity, that in your period of stress, this idea of conformity is further pushed, and consequently it makes it much easier to develop these techniques, and that it seems that politically, the extremities, there's a growing feeling that we have to do away with the extremities, and we have to keep on going the central path. And this would seem to me to make this much easier for a type of dictatorship, as you said, to slowly, using the mass media that we're developing, mold the population, plus the factor that in some of the other type societies, you have less inhibition about the brutal struggle for power within the top hierarchy, whereas here, there would be some type of a inhibition due to the so-called legal process that has developed, which would keep men from then violently attacking the leaders.
This business about conformity, I just don't know. It seems extremely difficult, certainly for me, to judge whether there is a higher degree of conformity here and now than there has been in other places and in the past. I would have thought the tendency towards conformity was to some extent offset by the enormous differentiation of function in modern society. That nothing could be less homogeneous in function than a complex modern society. People are doing extraordinarily different things. And although there may be a pressure to conformity in the suburbs, so to speak, at home, there does seem a considerable pressure to non-conformity or to differentiation in the functional life of people. I've no idea and to what extent one offsets the other, and whether the conforming drive is stronger than the drive towards differentiation. I just don't know what the answer to this. I mean, I read about the high degree of conformity, and of course one does see that certainly as compared with the 19th century, this society does seem to be more conformist. I mean, if one reads the history of the utopian colonies which were set up during the 19th century, this is really extravagant. I mean, that it's inconceivable to think of anything like the Oneida community or Brook Farm even being set up today. I mean, that this would be so outrageous that it would be impossible to imagine. And yet, in these Victorian days, there was this freedom to make experiments, social experiments of the wildest character. Again, exactly what this means and exactly what the significance is for us and for the future, I don't really know. I just feel so incapable of really understanding the unutterably odd facts of real life. I mean, I think one very often just has to accept them. There they are, and what really they mean, I don't know. I mean, perhaps this is one of the charms of history, that one never really knows what it means.
Yes, a gentleman, Maher.
Honestly, you have always been interested in religious ideas, problems and implications arising out of the use of artificial means of control, human beings. Would you care to comment on
that? Well, this is finally related to the whole mind-body problem. I mean, we still don't know very much about the relation of mind and body. I mean, we know clearly that they're related to one another very closely, but exactly how electrochemical events in the central nervous system turn into the G minor quartet of Mozart, we really haven't the faintest idea. I mean, I don't think we have any more idea than Aquinas or Aristotle. I mean, all we can say is that it happens. And we do know a good deal more about the nature of the electrical and the chemical events. But again, what the bridge is, and whether it's enough to say, like the neutral monists, that the two aspects, the mental and the physical, are merely the same thing seen from different sides. Again, I don't know. I mean, even then, I mean, how can the same thing look so profoundly different? Something I don't understand. And in relation to the mystical experience, I mean, clearly this is correlated with electrochemical states within the central nervous system, and I would be all for studying these states. I mean, I think it's exceedingly important that we should know about it. I mean, I can imagine a whole branch of science which would be called neurotheology or mycomysticism. I mean, this sounds funny, but nevertheless, it's we have to be able to speak in the same kind of language about the two aspects of any of these experiences, the neurological and the subjective. And then we, I suppose, on the philosophical level, we have to make the decision which William James posed for us. I mean, he says perfectly obvious that mind is a function of the nervous system, but is it a productive function or is it a transmissive function? I mean, it does, as Cabanis said at the beginning of the 19th century, does the brain secrete thought as the liver secretes bile? Or is it some kind of valve, as James himself, I think, thought, and as certainly as Bergson thought, through which a pre-existent mental element finds access into the human being. I mean, Bergson's view was that, of course, it was a kind of reducing valve which permitted only those aspects of a universal consciousness which were useful to our survival as animals on the surface of the planet and as social creatures within a society to come through. Well, I don't know. As James says, that the both points of view are quite difficult from a philosophical point of view to justify, but the transmissive view is no more difficult than the productive view, and perhaps he's right. I think my own view is that, on the whole, that he and Bergson were nearer the truth than the Cabanis, but I don't know.
This gentleman in the white shirt there.
Dr. Huxley, would you care to comment on Sir Julian Huxley's views on artificial insemination donation?
Well, I don't know that I know his views exactly.
I was going to ask. You care to clarify that for us?
I think he favors, along with a Dr. Herman Muller of Indiana University here in the United States, I think that we can genetically improve the human race by adopting amongst the population the practice of artificial insemination using the sperm of intelligent individuals, and I don't know how he determines that these individuals are to be chosen, but I was just wondering if you were familiar with these.
Well, I mean, this is, of course, the whole problem of eugenics. I mean, if one knew how to apply eugenic principles, I think unquestionably one could improve the average quality of the human race. And I mean, there is some evidence, as Bert pointed out a long time ago, and as Medawar has pointed out more recently, that there is some evidence that there is a slight decline of average IQ, and that this certainly could be remedied. But of course, as you say, the problem is to choose who. I mean, I can perfectly imagine that if the Cold War goes on for a very long time, that side which first starts artificial insemination for the production of people with greater talent in the physical sciences will win. And I read a paper the other day by, I forget who, a biologist at University of California at Santa Barbara. It was an amusing paper, but I mean, it had quite interesting and serious aspects to it on sort of the hypothetical Cold War action on the part of the dictatorial powers who were able to make use of eugenics in ways which would not, as this author's name I cannot now remember, in ways which were not necessarily very tyrannical, because after all, the woman would be allowed to marry whomever she liked, but provided she had children by selected fathers outside the relationship. So that, I mean, there would be the actual personal relationships between husband and wife would not be modified seriously. But, I mean, this, as I say, was a fantasy, but it looked like a fantasy which could quite likely come true and could, as the geneticists, I think, are all agreed, could certainly lead to considerable results. Of course, for eugenics to take place on any in a rapid way, you would have to be able to control the not merely the male genetic factors, but the female, which is, of course, much more difficult, but not impossible, I imagine.
I have one written question here I'd like to read out to you, sir. The population explosion is a grave danger to mankind, yet the right to bear children is a right of free will. The only apparent way to stem this explosion is by some large-scale kind of conditioning or external coercion. Yet this is also a grave danger. Is there any way out of this dilemma?
Well, the way out of the dilemma has surely been pointed out in most countries of the West, where people voluntarily have limited the size of their families. I mean, this has happened without any coercion, unless you call the desire to have a good economic life and to bring up your children well a coercion. But I mean, this has in fact occurred. I mean, in this country, after having reached a low during the Depression, the birth rate happens to have gone up. But I mean, the point is that the control of the size of families is now completely voluntary here, I mean, or more or less completely voluntary, and which makes it profoundly different from for the people in the underdeveloped societies who are still going on producing 10 children because the habit persists that in order to for 3 children to survive, you have to produce 10. But now if you produce 10 children, 7 survive because of elementary public health precautions which have been brought in. Hence, of course, the enormous sudden increase, the death rate, which used to be in the upper 30s, as was the birth rate, has now fallen in many of these countries to 15 and 12 and even 10. So naturally, there's an enormous increase. But it's certainly going to take some time to get people to change their habits. I mean, psychological inertia is much more powerful than physical inertia. I mean, it's much easier to push a 10-ton truck than a human being.
Mr. Post has one further question here.
You've spoken of the ends to which drugs should not be devoted, such as increasing conformity, making men more content with what is actually an intolerable situation, securing the power of a small elite, and so on. To what ends do you think these drugs should be devoted, granted that we have them?
Well, I mean, I think therapeutically some of them are very variable. I think already, for example, some of the so-called psychic energizers have done a great deal in the mental field. I mean, I understand from Dr. Nathan Klein, for example, that in very many cases you can use some of these psychic energizers instead of the electroshock therapy. And people say that electroshock therapy doesn't do any harm, but I cannot believe that partial electrocution is good for anybody. And it seems to me a very good thing that if you can get people on a maintenance dose to get them out of these awful catatonic and depressed conditions, which you seem to be able to do. And after all, there are many people, it seems to me, outside institutions who have tendencies in the same direction, which I think a genuine psychic energizer might be which could be used without harm to people, would be of immense value. There was even, it was stated a few years ago, I remember, that the Russians had a 5-year plan for increasing mental efficiency by chemical means. I don't know whether this has gone on and what they've discovered, but I would think it's probably on the cards that you could increase the span of attention, the amount of time you could concentrate on things, the power of observation and so on, by chemical as well as by educational means. I mean, I think that there are a number of probably quite good things you could do. And then, again, in the case of these very strange substances like psilocybin and lysergic acid, I think there's a great deal to be said for doing what William James talked about, for getting people to realize that their ordinary sort of common sense view of the world is not the only view, that the universe they inhabit is not the only possible universe, and that there are other very strange universes which some people spontaneously inhabit. I mean, a man like William Blake obviously inhabits an extremely different universe from that which most people inhabit. And I think it's probably very wholesome for people to be permitted to realize this fact, to perceive that the world of the mind is immensely large, and that there are these very strange and extraordinary areas in them, and there are plenty of cases in the literature where these kind of experiences have produced a kind of conversion. The work which is being done at Harvard now by Leary in the prison, in the local prisons in Boston, is very interesting, a sort of a series of extraordinary conversion experiences among hardened criminals have emerged from this. And here again, there may be, I mean, we don't know enough about the subject yet, but there may be possibilities of very great importance here. Of sort of removing obstacles. I mean, the justification here was stated by Bergson years ago when he was defending William James against his use of nitrous oxide. A number of fellow philosophers thought this was infradig, that an eminent philosopher should resort to these chemical means, which enabled, I mean, James remarked that only under nitrous oxide could he understand what Hegel meant. Bergson said that it must be realized that the experiences which Mr. James describes are not caused by the gas. The gas is merely the occasion. The gas is removes certain obstacles which might have been removed equally well by psychological or psychophysical means, so-called spiritual exercises of the various religions, but can also be removed by these chemical means, and that if you can do so without doing harm to yourself, so much the better. And incidentally, it's one of the great tragedies, I think, in psychological research that James, I think in about 1905, made an experiment with peyote, and as he had a rather weak stomach, all that he got was violent vomiting. He says, "I'm afraid I must take the visions for granted. I got only the nausea." And it's an awful pity. If he'd had a stronger stomach, we should have had this research beginning 50 years ago. But his weak stomach prevented this, and we've had to wait till much later to get this thing really going.
Well, before we close the program, Mr. Delaney, Graduate Student Association, asked me to announce that there'll be a meeting of the Graduate Student Association next Tuesday at noon. Now, I want to express our appreciation to Mr. Huxley on behalf of all of those who are fearful lest our augmented knowledge restrict our understanding. Thank you very much. Thank you.